Wow. Triple Play Thursday, man. Triple Play Thursday continues with requests from our listeners. Hey, I got to tell you, I'm enjoying our listeners this morning, Dan. I have to tell you.
Good cuts.
Wow. For Triple Play Thursday, the deal is you can text in 312-981-7200, an artist, pick three songs, and we'll play them on Triple Play Thursday coming back from commercials, and you get to hear what you want to hear here on Triple Play Thursday. Steve has requested The Clash. Wow, man. This is going to be, if this continues throughout through 5 a.m., we're going to have the best Triple Play Thursday yet. Dmitry Samarov is here. Hi, Dmitry.
Hello.
Are you familiar with Triple Play Thursday?
No, not as of yet.
Okay, Triple Play Thursday is a lot of FM classic rock stations do Triple Play Thursday. Well, they'll play three songs in a row by an artist. Mm. So we're doing that with our bumps. And so we let people text in 312-981-7200 with artists. And so far this morning, we've had Uriah Heep. And now Steve has chosen The Clash.
All right.
Which makes me very happy. How are you, Dimitri?
Not bad.
Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Thank you.
For point of reference and history, Dimitri is a really great artist and was a cab driver in Boston and here in Chicago and documented both of those adventures in two different books that were both very, very good. And you have since stopped driving a cab. Mm-hmm. You still do etchings and drawings and paintings.
Yes.
As an artist. And now you have become a columnist for The Reader and a book reviewer as well.
Yeah, for The Reader and for The Tribune occasionally.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's for the Printer's Row.
Very, very cool.
Journal.
Very cool. Well, we're going to talk about all that new stuff. But you walked in here with a book that I am you're going to review for The Trib.
Yeah, it's called Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements, written by Bob Mayer, who used to write for The Reader probably about a decade ago. And it's an exhaustively researched and detailed biography of the late great. Well, I guess they've risen again, but
they had a comeback tour two years ago. Yeah,
some mongrel version of them appeared a couple of years ago. I think that's where the book ends up. Actually,
it's because they played a Riot Fest. That's when they reunited. Yeah. I adore the Replacements, and I can't wait to read this book. And I had read an excerpt. I was telling you off the air that earlier this week, in fact, RollingStone.com, because the book has just come out.
I think it came out a few weeks ago.
Yeah, so they put an excerpt on the website on RollingStone.com about the Replacements' one and only and very infamous appearance on SNL. And just that little portion alone was really well written. It was a lot of fun to read. And if you're a fan of the band, you know. So you're going to review it when it looks like you're almost done with it, about three quarters of the way through.
Yeah, I'll get it done and get a review written this weekend. And usually the turnaround's 2-3 weeks or so.
Yeah.
It'll be in the Printer's Row Literary Supplement and online.
Online.
As well, yeah. Okay. Actually, the Printer's Row is exclusively digital now, but...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They switched it over to the world of digital. But, yeah, I've had a bunch of reviews in there lately. I just had one go live this morning, which is kind of an academic book about comics and how they portray war.
Yeah, I read it. I got it in front of me. I'll talk about that in a second here. Just really quickly about the Replacements book. You were saying off the air, it's interesting because you can be very objective about this because you're not that you hate the Replacements, but you're not necessarily a fan.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm not in love with that band.
Yeah.
I like songs here or there, but it's been interesting to really dive in and without a really particular strong point of view. It's probably better.
It probably is. It's going to be impossible for me to be objective because I happen to love the band.
Like I told you, I think you'll enjoy this book, and I think basically it's the kind of biography that anybody that does anything creative would love to have written about them.
Oh, cool.
I mean, the exhaustive attention to detail, you know.
Yeah, I'm looking at
He's pretty even-handed, but he obviously loves the Replacements, or he wouldn't have spent 10 years of his life doing this.
Absolutely. Now, I don't know how far you are in the book, but, you know, one of the great huge connections between this city and the Replacements is that they broke up on stage here.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if that's
there's
where
a photograph in there.
I was there.
Oh, were you?
Oh, yeah, 4th of July, 1991. I was there at Grant Park.
Okay.
And they broke up on stage. You're thinking?
Yeah, I was here.
July 4th, 1991 is when it happened. It was at the Petrillo Band Shell.
Obviously, I wasn't a fan. Well, did they play, was it like Taste of Chicago?
Yeah.
Oh, it was?
Yep.
Okay.
It was during Taste of Chicago. It was a Petrillo Band Shell.
That's funny. I could have gone to that show, but I didn't because I didn't care about the replacements.
Right. I of course was there, and they at one point they started switching instruments, and
that was one of their they had a lot of gags, a lot of routines that basically I mean one of the things you learn, and it's not, you know, they were famous for being a drunken sort of train wreck, but
yeah.
It goes back through their history to the childhood and. Paul Westerberg would spend all this time in the library reading up on showbiz, and he read like all about P.T. Barnum. So he had this show, this thing of putting on a show in his head, like since he was a kid.
Yeah.
So there was some sort of method to the madness. It wasn't just that they were completely out of control.
Right. Well, I'm excited about that book and reading it, and I'm looking forward to your review. Let's get back. You mentioned the book. Disaster Drawn is the name of the
Disaster
book.
Disaster Drawn, yeah.
Yeah, Disaster Drawn. And tell us about that. Your review just went live. I've got it. I read it. It's really interesting. I'd love to get the book. Tell me about that
yeah,
book.
Yeah, it's kind of an academic book, so some of the language is a little bit of a slog, but it's a really interesting idea. So her idea is that comics throughout history are able to portray war and other conflict. All the stuff she covers is basically nonfiction.
Yeah.
Nonfiction comics, but the way it was portrayed by artists through the ages, and then eventually comics artists, which comics, one way or another, were invented in the 19th century, and as a way to sort of bear witness. So, like, one of the people she covers is this artist that survived Hiroshima as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote this, like, sort of searing, you know, account of that, which he wasn't allowed to publish, which was suppressed, but eventually came out.
And it was drawn. It was written, like, in the form of comics?
Yeah, yeah. Comics with panels.
Yeah.
And Mouse is another huge part of this book, Art Spiegelman's Mouse, which is an account of his father's time in the concentration camps. And it's, you know, it's put through this conceit of mice and cats, but it's all about the Nazis, and it's all from an oral history that he took from his father's experiences, firsthand experience.
The author is Hilary Shute.
Hilary Shute, who's a professor at University of Chicago.
But she maintains the argument of the book is that she maintains that there is as much validity in drawings and comics as there are in historical photos.
Or written accounts. And that there's things that this way of telling the story can give you, like aspects of looking at these conflicts that the other mediums can't.
Now, as a visual artist yourself, do you think that that's a valid argument?
I think she's got I can buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And does she is it brought across interestingly enough? I know that at one point you said that some of the quotes and get a little distracting that she has, or some
she is an academic, so what academics do is endlessly quote other academics, and that may put off some readers, but I would still recommend the book just for the ideas in it, and then it's got really nice color reproductions.
Mm-hmm.
She traces this long history from going back like 400 years.
It goes back that far.
Yeah, yeah. She goes back to this artist named Jacques Callot who made etchings which documented a war in France sort of really viscerally, just what like the soldiers did and that he witnessed. And they're not exactly comics, but they're prints with some written pieces on the bottom. And for her, she traces that as sort of a beginning of kind of a graphic / written kind of account of war.
So there's reproductions in the book and stuff like that.
Yeah,
where are these actual drawings? Where she had to look, she had to actually find them. Are they kept in museums? Are they kept, you know, in different?
There are books of all these these things throughout the ages. And like she goes from this artist Kahlo to Francisco Goya, who was about a century later in Spain, who was also documenting. He had a famous series of prints called "The Disasters of War," which kind of another graphic depiction of atrocities committed by soldiers in like a conflict in Spain.
And this book is, you said it's an academic book, but can anybody get it?
It's not, of course.
Yeah.
Academic in terms of
the way it's styled.
Some of the language.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you'd recommend it though?
Absolutely.
All right, cool. Yeah. So that's Disaster Drawn, and that's Hillary Schutte, her last name is spelled C-H-U-T-E.
Yeah.
C-H-U-T-E. Okay, we're going to take a break, Dmitry. Samarov is here. We're going to talk more about what he's been working on and all kinds of other stuff. There's some columns, including a column that you wrote about a show that you and I share an absolute love for.
Absolutely.
And we'll talk about that coming up, a TV show, and we'll talk about that.
It's a tease. We won't say what it is.
That's right. We won't tell you until you come back. All right, we'll take a break. Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. The boys and boys are standing on the radiator grill. Show me if I'm dying. Morning, everybody. Hey. This is also from Steve, right? Dan? Nick DiGilio here on the overnights, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Like us on Facebook. We're going to hit 12,000 fans soon. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. So like us. Steve requested the Clash for Triple Play Thursday, and that's our second of the Clash Triple Play. And my guest is Dmitry Samarov, live in studio. Good to see you again, Dmitry.
Likewise.
And it's nice that we're going to have you on pretty regularly now.
Sure. Yeah. It'll be good.
Are you enjoying this? You know, I mean, I've known you for a long time.
Yeah.
And I know that writing was never something that you had consciously sought to do, but you've become a writer. You've become a reviewer.
I'm certainly consciously seeking to do it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really regular thing now.
How has that turned out for you?
It's been interesting, especially since the beginning of this year and this regular thing with the Reader, where, you know, I'm pitching stuff to them every week and, a lot of it is getting accepted. So then I have to quickly turn this stuff around and crank it out.
Yeah.
It's sort of like going to the gym, but, you know, for writing.
But for writing.
I think it's serving some sort of purpose. I mean, hopefully, occasionally, the pieces are entertaining.
They are.
People want to read them. But
I'm not just saying that because you're a friend of mine.
I think there's some larger purpose with this, which will reveal itself maybe somewhere down the line.
Well, having known you and I know your work, not just your writing but your art, and having been a subject of a portrait that you did of me, which hangs in my bedroom.
Right, and a black and white reproduction of which is featured in my second book.
Oh, so that's right. Well, first of all, tell everybody about the two books that you did, which chronicled not just with words, but with your drawings.
Yeah, sort of similarly as we were talking about the Disaster Drawn.
Right.
Mine wasn't a chronicle of war exactly, but it was a chronicle of life driving a cab in Chicago and in Boston. Mm-hmm. And so the first book, which came out from University of Chicago Press, is Hack, Stories from a Chicago Cab, which followed in 2014 by Where To, a Hack Memoir from Curbside Splendor.
And they're really interesting books. How long did you – 8 years you drove here?
Nine
here.
Three in Boston, nine
here. Okay, so a total of 12 years
it's a good chunk.
And, yeah, it's a lot. And the other thing about it was that you drove every time we talk about you driving a cab, Taxi Driver comes up, the movie.
Right. I go anywhere, anytime.
That's right. And you did.
Just like Travis Bickle.
Just like Travis Bickle, although you're not insane. Or as insane as he is.
Different kind of insane,
But you did do that. You drove anywhere, anytime. You didn't care.
Not out to assassinate any presidential candidates, although lately it's become more and more tempting. I gotta tell you,
it's been terrifying, hasn't it? I mean, it's terrifying.
We're not gonna, use that name because each time you say that name, it's free publicity.
Yeah, exactly. So
not gonna say it.
Yeah, and I think everybody. Well, there's a few names that we could say that would be free publicity for people that don't need free publicity.
Yeah, but we know which.
Yeah. So anyway, you chronicle a lot of that stuff. Some of it pretty scary. There are some things in both books that were a little bit scary. And did some of these events that you that you wrote about or actually etched or drew about, did they ever at any point did you go, I'm not going to drive here anymore and I'm not going to do this anymore? Did it ever make you were you ever cautious?
I was cautious, sure. For sure. I mean, it's like any job out in a city. You have to be aware of your surroundings and you have to make quick judgments about the people you're dealing with,
right.
For sure. But I guess I never had an experience so bad that it put me off like a whole neighborhood, say. Mm-hmm. Or yeah.
I was actually in the cab with you one time. We got rear-ended.
Were you?
Yeah.
Where did we get rear-ended?
It was getting on the feeder ramp at Ontario. We were going down Ontario, getting on the. It was a Friday night, so all the idiots were out in that area. You know what I'm talking about? All the 4 o'clock idiot bars that are right by. Franklin and
Yeah. Well, that happened multiple times.
Oh yeah, so, but no. Like, I mean, and it was like,
it wasn't a big deal.
He took off. Yeah, he took off. Yeah. He rear-ended us. Yeah. There was no damage or anything. Right. It was a pretty solid hit, though.
Yeah,
I remember bopping out of the seat, but the dude took off. But that happens. Did it happen?
In the last few months I was driving, I had like a scarier one where it was somewhere up in Ravenswood or something, and I'm driving along and I have a customer. And I look in my rearview mirror, and suddenly there's a car back there, and it speeds up and just slams into me.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah. They're going along, and suddenly she like guns it, like right in, and there's no damage, but we're
Did they take off?
No. We pulled over, and it was a girl. She was driving with a guy in the passenger seat, and they were having a fight, and you know. I guess she got a little excited.
And she gunned it.
And she gunned it.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. And it was like, of course, it was like 3 or 4 in the morning.
Sure. Yeah. You know, well, but, I mean, you drove those hours.
Yeah.
Did you always drive those hours or did you make a switch?
I switched when I first, let's see, in Boston, a lot of time I gravitated towards those hours. But at first in Chicago, because when I started driving, I was married. And my ex-wife had a day job, you know, like morning. So I was trying to sync up to her schedule.
Right.
So I would do the 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. shift.
Yeah.
But after we broke up, I gradually switched over to the nights. Because, I mean, in my experience in that job, you pick up people in the morning and they're just mad at the world. You know, like you pick them up first thing and they don't want to be going. At least with drunks in my experience are just much more docile, easier to deal with.
Right.
Plus, worse at math, too, which worked out in my favor sometimes.
That guy just gave me a $20 tip on a $5 ride.
I once got $60 to go literally 3 buildings.
Wait a minute. How do I not know that story?
You don't know this story?
No,
okay.
Wait.
So this is in...
Maybe you told me. I've quit drinking since then, so maybe,
You forgot most of the
stories. I forgot a lot of the stories, yeah.
So I picked up this guy from a gas station in Ukrainian Village. I remember exactly what... It was a gas station at the corner of Damon and Augusta.
Okay.
And he's wasted. He's just wasted. But he's come out of there. He's just used the ATM, and he wants to go home, and he gives me his address, and his address is 3 houses away from this gas station. So I get in, I put on the meter, it's a 225,
right,
and go up 3 buildings,
right,
and he looks, he doesn't recognize this house, of course,
man.
You know, and he's so happy, he gives me a 20, he's just happy, and he goes off, and I look, and they're brand new, the 320,
they stuck together,
320
out of
stuck
ATM.
Together, but I figure, you know, that's the karmic, restoring the karmic balance for all the people that threw up, the people that stiffed me.
That
so,
stiffed you. That I mean,
you
that
know,
had,
if I was a real jerk, I could have just gone in and robbed him, you know?
Not only that, you could have drove him around for an hour and a half.
I could have done whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
He didn't know where he didn't recognize his house from two buildings away. So
that's
that
insane.
Was the best.
Did you watch him get into, did he get into his house?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. For $60, yeah.
I waited, like, you I became his guardian angel at that point,
yeah.
Gonna make sure this guy gets in safe. He'll wake up in the morning, not even remember. You know what? He won't be missing money out of his wallet because he took $60 out of the ATM. Won't remember that.
No.
But then look at his bank account and go, where the hell did that $60 go that I needed to pay my rent?
Well, you know what? People can afford to take cabs and go out drinking all night.
Yeah.
They can part with an extra 20 or 40. That's
taking a cab three houses. Yeah, okay. All right, Dimitri, hang on. I want to get back into some of the stuff that you've written about. We will also talk about the TV show that Dimitri wrote about for The Reader, a show that both Dimitri and I really, really love, and you should be watching. All right, we'll take a quick break. It's been mentioned, by the way. It's not like I haven't talked about this show.
Sure.
I have, but we'll talk about it coming up right after we take a break for the news on WGN. Morning, everybody. Hi, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Here till 5 a.m., Steve Grzanich and the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6. 312-981-7200, talk and text. That's Steve's third Clash song for his Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, Triple Play Thursday. And we're taking requests for Triple Play Thursday songs, three songs by one artist that you request, and we'll play them after the commercial breaks and stuff like that. So 312-981-7200. Coming up after 4 o'clock, Zero Gravity is closing, which was a teen nightclub, a very popular teen nightclub for a couple of decades. And it's closing, and we're going to talk about that and talk about places that you hung out when you were a teenager. What were your places that you hung out? But currently, Dmitry Samarov is with us. Terrific writer and a good artist and a good friend. Dmitry, welcome back.
Thank you.
Where did you hang out when you were a teenager? You were a teenager in Boston, correct?
Yeah. Where did I
did
hang
you? Was there a place that you hung? Was there a high school hangout or anything like that?
I didn't have many friends in high school, but I worked at a movie theater, kind of like an artsy movie theater, kind of like the Music Box.
Right.
So I think a lot of the friends I made were there, really, more than any high school place. I was just telling, I was at work earlier. I work at a bar now, and the bartender put on Nick Cave, and I was telling him that the first time I saw Nick Cave was in the late 80s with my fake high school ID.
So you had a fake ID.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
So, yeah, every once in a while I get into it.
One of my favorite lines in Breakfast Club is when they're looking through each other's the wallets, and Anthony Michael Hall, who plays like the dorky book nerd guy, they look, you know, and Emilio Estevez is like, this is the worst fake ID that I've ever seen in my life. You realize this makes you 35 years old? And he's like, oh, all right. And then they're like, why do you have a fake ID? Anthony Michael Hall's response is, so I can vote.
Right.
it's like one of my favorite lines in the movie. All right. We've been teasing this television show. It's a show that I've talked about on the air several times. I have a guy who joins me every couple of weeks, Dan Feinberg. He writes for The Hollywood Reporter, and we talk TV.
Okay.
So the show that you wrote about, it has been mentioned many, many times, and that show is Baskets.
Right.
Zach Galifianakis is terrific. Show on FX. I hasten to call it a comedy.
It's sort of a comedy, but it's a really, really dark kind of existentialist comedy.
So you wrote a piece about it. Did you pitch this idea to The Reader and say, hey, I'd like to write about this?
Yeah, I did. Most of the stuff in The Reader, and actually in the Tribune too, lately at least, is stuff I'm pitching them.
Yeah.
Like I'm sort of scouring stuff like art shows and books and movies and other stuff that I want to write about. And, I've gotten a lot more accepted than rejected.
That's good.
Which is really nice.
All right. In terms of your experience with Baskets, was it something that you were interested in at the get-go or just something that you stumbled upon?
I saw there was like what I wasn't sure if I would like it. I've been pretty lukewarm on most of the stuff that Zach Galifianakis has done up to this.
I've been less than lukewarm on his movies.
I don't even know his movies. What movies?
Oh, he's in The Hangover. Which
oh, right.
Is like the,
well,
you know,
but that's not even on my radar.
No, I know it's not.
But
most of the movies that he's been in are not on your radar because they suck and they're not.
Right.
I don't think they're indicative of Zach Galifianakis' talent. I've seen him do some stand-up, which is really funny and creative and weird. He did a series on Funny or Die called Between Two Ferns.
I've heard of that.
Which is very funny.
It's like a talk show,
yes,
right?
Yes, and he has like guests on, like big guests.
Right, he had Obama on, right?
He did, and he had Brad. He has like Brad Pitt on. He calls him Bradley Pitts. and like doesn't, and it's just really uncomfortable and very, very, very funny. And the set is just like two chairs and two ferns.
Yeah, but it's
that stuff is funny. But anything that you see big screen wise,
no,
terrible.
I haven't seen any of that. But I saw a comedy special, which I sort of was not quite sold on. And he's got this sort of deadpan kind of underplayed delivery that he does.
Yeah.
And there's this like sort of low level tension through and kind of hostility to everything that he does.
Absolutely.
But for whatever reason, and I think Louis C.K., who's one of the creators of Baskets, has a lot to do with it. He cast it, you know, he asked him, I think he approached him to do this.
Yeah.
His brand of humor totally works for this. And he also, he plays this failed clown. The world's saddest, angriest clown, basically, and his twin brother, who's this closet gay man who's running like a for-profit community college, of which he's also a student. And he films like, you know, the world's worst promos
and infomercials and stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of like DeVry or something, but like three levels lower.
Right. and it's hard. He went to France. He failed out of clown college.
Yes.
In France. He married a French woman.
Who only agreed because she wanted to see America. And
to get a green card.
To get a green card. And once they got to America, refuses to be in the same room with him, basically. And, you know.
Then he gets a job at a rodeo.
Yeah, and he becomes a rodeo clown. But I think what actually convinced me to give this show a try is that some of these promos of him dressed as a clown, and because I think in the minority one of the people that like clowns. I like them, not in any weird way, and I'm not creeped out by them. But, this image of this sad, like sort of classic clown, totally missing, you know, not getting the memo at all about anything.
And
in the show, pretty much every character is a failure of one kind or another and is missing the mark by like a wide margin.
Right.
But the greatest character on the show is Zach Galifianakis' mom, who is played by Louis Anderson.
Right. And it's not a stunt performance.
No, it's played completely straight.
Yep.
And she's, I mean, it's almost like a Shakespearean tragic, larger than life person that's sort of consuming every piece of junk that's sold to her and is just in love with it.
Yeah.
I mean, the line that stuck with me that I quoted in my piece was how she was just fascinated by how curly fries are made, and wouldn't it be something to be able to do that yourself at home?
And it's hard to describe when you tell people, and I've told people over this, you know, and when you say, Louis Anderson plays Zach Galifianakis' mother, you immediately think, oh, it's going to be wacky, wacky drag performance. It's not that at all.
Yeah.
Like it's when I was talking to Dan Feinberg about the show, I mentioned, that, you know, Linda Hunt played a man in The Year of Living Dangerously.
Sure.
And she won an Academy Award for it. And it's that nobody ever questioned whether it was a stunt performance. She just happened to be a woman playing this role.
Yeah.
And it's on that, this performance is on that level. It is absolutely on that level.
Yeah.
Played straight, and it's brilliant, and it's heartbreaking, and it's funny, and it's weird.
Yeah.
And you wrote a really great piece about it. I also want to, we haven't mentioned Martha, who, besides Louis Anderson, is my favorite character on the show.
Yeah, Martha's another, and it's great when they're both when they're together in the same scene. And Martha is Zach Galifianakis' claims adjuster from Costco, who becomes his driver and basically only friend, who he verbally abuses over and over again, and doesn't seem to understand is on his side.
Yeah.
And who has a cast on her arm that never seems to heal, which is a symbol of something, like who at one point adopts a coyote who tears up her whole apartment. I mean, everything that happens to these people is just horrendous.
Yeah.
But you kind of can't look away.
The episode, the last episode, if I remember correctly, because sometimes I get the, I mean, well, I just want to mention very quickly, the Easter episode might be my favorite one of the season so far, where they go to the buffet and they sit with Martha's parents.
Yeah.
And just,
that's good. And the other sequence is another one I describe is when the mother takes the horrible French wife on a tour of Bakersfield.
Yeah.
And then has her deported back to France.
Yeah.
I love that whole
thing. That's great. It's beautiful. Yeah. It's great. That's my favorite. But the one that was on last week was where they take the road trip with the cowboy.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
they end up going to – and it's Meg Foster. Meg Foster plays the old prostitute.
Is that Meg Foster?
It's Meg Foster. Okay. And I was like, oh, my God, that's Meg Foster. And she really just no makeup, showing her age.
Yeah.
And looked – older, and I met Meg Foster a few years ago at the Flashback Horror Convention because she's in They Live,
and
a couple of, so she did the Flashback Horror Convention, she did the autograph route, and I met her and she looked older, but not, I think they obviously made her look a lot more rough.
Yeah,
but that's probably why you didn't recognize her, because it was like, oh my God, I had to.
She looked familiar, but I couldn't place her.
And she was fabulous in it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a great performance, and Baskets falls in love, basically falls in love with her in that motherly way.
Yeah,
it was so creepy and so awesome and so funny. Yeah. Now I don't, you're not a big. I know you're not a huge TV watcher, but when you watch TV, it's few and far between when you get hooked on something, right?
Lately, and there's all these interesting shows, and I don't have a TV. I watch everything on my laptop.
Yeah,
I mean,
a lot of people do.
Yeah,
yeah.
I like this way of watching series. You know, a few at a time. That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
I like that.
Well, but it's a really cool piece. And when did that run, the Baskets piece?
Last week.
Yeah.
Yeah, this week there's a piece about the Van Gogh show.
Okay, we're going to talk about that.
Right.
And I also want to talk about the book that the woman wrote about how much Madonna inspired her, but not in the right way.
Madonna Land.
Madonna
Land, that was from
a
couple of weeks
ago. We'll talk about that as well. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower. It's Triple Play Thursday. And on the screen here, Dominic from Franklin Park requested ELO. So we've got three ELO songs here for Triple Play Thursday. But Dan, I just want you to know that you typed Tripe Play Thursday. So it's a stomach lining Thursday.
Delicious.
Don't cows have three stomachs?
Yeah, so they can spare a tripe. Yeah, because they got two more.
Sure. A way to describe ELO.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's the voice of Dmitry Samarov, who writes book reviews for The Trib and writes a bunch of columns for The Reader. Let's talk about the piece that you wrote about the Van Gogh exhibit.
Right.
And the fact that people were paying money to try to live a little bit like Van Gogh. Or live in his bedroom, or stay in his bedroom. Explain that, and it's really interesting. It's a really fun and interesting piece.
Okay, well, one of the I'm sure a lot of people have already heard about this because it's wildly successful.
Yes,
the Art Institute has this show called Van Gogh's Bedrooms, which collects these three versions of a painting of his bedroom. And one of their marketing gimmicks is an Airbnb room that they rent out that's tricked out to look like this bedroom.
Right.
And it's been wildly successful. There's a waiting list. Like, nobody can get in. But I don't really care for that gimmick or any of the other ones that they've sort of, like, attached to this miserable man who only sold one painting in his life.
Yeah.
And who's been marketed to death. Somehow, for some reason, he's... His work has resonated with people, and he's sort of like, the Beatles of art, where any which way you can repackage the guy, it happens.
Yeah.
And they sell it and sell it and sell it and sell it.
You point out something in the piece that, the guy obviously has been romanticized in the fact that, he was a depressed, dark guy, cut off his ear because he was passionate, and then he shot himself in a wheat field. And then that's been romanticized. But you actually bring up a really interesting point. You being an artist yourself, one of the things that, artists would like to do is sell their work.
Yeah.
And the fact that only one, you know, you talk about what would Van Gogh been like had he sold more than one painting?
Yeah. The thing is that, yeah, he would have probably wanted to live longer. And the other thing is, although the show goes to absurd lengths to put us into this bedroom, there's these kind of maps, there's these actual recreations in it, all this like multimedia stuff in there. It's like a children's museum exhibit, aside from the artwork, because I guess artwork's not good enough to speak for itself anymore. But the thing is that none of those museum visitors would ever want to spend a minute with Van Gogh in real life. I'm convinced of this. Mm-hmm. I don't think they would piss on him if he was on fire.
Yeah.
Because he's a sad, miserable man. And he probably was not that pleasant. Yet somehow all his work has been turned around into this cash cow.
Yeah.
And for somebody like me who's been doing art for 30 years and, you know, hasn't kind of set the world on fire with it, it's just frustrating and kind of horrible to watch him being trotted out again.
And, yeah. Now, personally, what do you think of his art?
There's some really good work in there.
Yeah.
But it's harder and harder to look at outside of this kind of crass commercial.
In the piece you write specifically about one painting that stood out for you, and it involved his shoes.
Yeah,
and it was unlike most of the stuff that you know about Van Gogh in terms of his work.
It was an earlier piece, and it wasn't with bright colors or sort of ecstatic, like marveling at the joy of creation, which a lot of his paintings concern, sort of like the wonders of nature and stuff.
Right.
And there's kind of like an ecstatic quality, kind of like a manic quality to a lot of his art.
Yeah.
But this is it's a very dark painting. It's just done with sort of like earth tones, browns and beige tones, and it's just his shoes, and they're beat to hell. And those communicate pretty well, I think, what it means to like live hard and like what it is to be alive.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of good artwork in this show, but you've got to ignore these videos and recreations and all this other claptrap.
Yeah.
To get to it.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of the points, the ultimate point of the piece that you wrote, at least, is that those shoes that you look at in this painting that he did.
Yeah.
It's a painting, right?
It's a painting.
Okay. In this painting that he did, those are shoes that, if given the chance, a lot of the people who are going to this exhibit would never put on.
No.
They would never want to wear, never want to
step
into.
Yeah, and this, just kind of like that Airbnb that's tricked out to look like his bedroom, we'd rather go through these experiences sort of vicariously or play act. I think one of the things I compared it to was like LARPing, you know, live action role play, instead of actually living any of these lives.
Yeah.
Most museum visitors and most of us wouldn't want to do this. Given the chance.
Before we let you go, I do want to mention the other piece that you wrote, and it's this book. you wrote about a woman who wrote a book called, is it called Madonna Land?
Madonna Land. Yeah.
Okay, and I happen to be a big Madonna fan, but that has nothing to do with it. It's an interesting. What's her take on this?
So
she's not a fan of Madonna, by the way.
Not especially. Yeah. Well, the backstory, her name is Alina Simone, and for about a decade, she was a singer-songwriter. She toured the country. She put out a couple of records.
Yeah.
And it's a very hard way to make a living. And then she transitioned into writing. She's written a couple of books before this, one memoir and one novel. And she was assigned, she was commissioned to do this book about Madonna. And there's been a billion books written about Madonna. And she basically, the book is a chronicle of her fighting herself, not wanting to write this book, kind of.
Right.
But what she ends up doing is going to Madonna's hometown and finding out that there's no mention of Madonna there. And she starts to investigate why. And like through the lens of this, you know, the most successful female artist of all time, she sort of examines her own career and what it is to be successful or a failure in America.
Yeah.
It's a really good kind of thoughtful, personal kind of journey.
Yeah. I really do. I want to get this book as well after reading the piece. The one thing that you point out that she has in the book is that there's a guy in her hometown, who has like tattoos of her, And she's, you know, like has tattoos and is trying to get her to get a street named after her or something.
That's a couple of different things.
Oh, I'm sorry. Two different things. Yeah.
There's a guy somewhere in the New York area where she lives who is like one of Madonna's biggest fans.
He's the guy with the tattoos and stuff.
He tattoos every one of, like over time, he has tattooed every one of her record covers on his body. But through spending time with him, she realizes that he loves Madonna in a way that she or any of her like cool indie rock friends, none of them love the music they love the way this guy loves Madonna.
Yeah.
It's pure and sort of unintellectual.
Like just joy.
Yeah, and there. Yeah. So that's one of the insights. But the other thing, the other guy that's in a quest to make a street sign in the hometown, it's this guy named Gary something, but in Bay City, Michigan, who basically he just wants the town to acknowledge that it's the birthplace of Madonna, and they won't do it. And at a certain point, like right when she was starting to get famous, she was about to get the keys to the city. And then the nude photos came out, and it was all canceled, and she hasn't been there since.
Right, and it's, you know, it's interesting. I love that. I love the idea, but I also think it's interesting that there was an appreciation by the author. Like, look, if this woman brings this much joy to somebody, that's, you know, there's something to be said for that. Yeah. What's really funny is that I remember, and we got to hit the break here, but I remember when they were trying to get a street named after Richard Pryor in Peoria, and the people were like, no. He's terrible. He's blah, 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 blah. He's one of the greatest artists that's ever existed, one of the most profound entertainers of all time.
Sure.
And just because he used the F word a lot, they didn't want it. And finally, he did get a street named after him. But I remember it was a huge struggle, which is just ridiculous.
Yep.
Okay. Dimitri, always great to see you, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I'm looking forward to the book, to the review of the replacement book, which you'll hear.
Yeah, it should be out in 2 or 3 weeks.
And just keep it up. And your website?
DimitriSamarov.com. If you want to keep up with me, I send out every Monday morning, I send out a kind of a newsletter of what I'm up to.
Okay.
You can sign up at tinyletter.com/Samarov.
Okay. Thank you, Dimitri. We'll take a quick break. The news is coming up next.